Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
Israel's leader in legal jeopardy, today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. An election is coming up, but Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is facing criminal charges.
He could win the election and he could still end up in jail. Anything goes right now.
The oceans are losing oxygen, and that's a threat to sea life.
If you can't breathe, nothing else matters.
100 years ago, American soldiers fought in Russia against the Bolsheviks. It didn't go well.
Oh, it was an abject failure. I mean, they didn't accomplish anything. They were lucky to get out with their lives.
And Brazilians prepare for carnival with music, dance, and politics.
It's a samba about warrior women, she says, adding black women practically founded Brazil.
Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is looking to make history. If he wins re-election next month, Netanyahu will become the longest-serving Israeli premier, outlasting even the founder of the Jewish state, David Ben-Gurion. There's one possible wrinkle here, though. He might also end up in jail.
Masat Said Hasar Takdim Shematrato Achat.
Netanyahu says there's a conspiracy by the political left to take him down. A witch hunt, we might say in English. But the charges are real. Noga Tarnopolsky is a reporter based in Jerusalem.
He's facing, formally we're talking about fraud, bribery, and breach of trust. More broadly, we're basically talking about a head of government who is accused of running an ugly operation in the last few years with a heavy whiff of racketeering in which he not only offered, you know, political assistance and power to people who either offered him money or other benefits, or simply operated as if he were above the law.
Now, of course, Netanyahu is denying all these charges, but the timing couldn't be worse for him politically. I mean, it's exactly 40 days to the next election in Israel. That's kind of a tough spot.
It's all a tough spot, and I think basically we're dealing with an unprecedented and extremely complex situation. So one of the things I'd say is that both of the possibilities you outlined initially are possible. He could win the election and he could still end up in jail. Anything goes right now. Israelis have never before had a prime minister indicted. They've never before had someone running for re-election as head of government indicted. And it's unclear how Israelis are going to reflect on this or feel. But with the political situation so polarized and so fraught, it's hard to know how it's going to pan out. The other thing that's interesting is that more than denying the accusations, as you said, what Netanyahu has done instead is go on the attack. He's been accused in 3 separate criminal cases, and in one of them, called Case 1000, basically he's accused of asking some billionaire supporters he's accused of demanding or asking them for very expensive gifts on Israeli terms in the hundreds of thousands of dollars, cigars, champagne, jewelry for his wife, that kind of thing, in exchange for some political leniency. What's interesting is that he hasn't denied those charges. He simply says, I'm allowed to receive gifts from my friends. Mostly, he's simply gone on an attack. He's attacked Israel's judiciary. He attacks the media. He attacks the police. He attacks his opponents. He described himself in a furious speech he gave last night as the most maligned man in Israeli history. And when you put that kind of an awareness, he has a very acute awareness of himself as a victim, I'd say, for someone who's been head of this state for 10 years. And I think that much of the Israeli reaction may hinge on that. In other words, are people willing to accept a prime minister who, to a great extent, says, the laws don't matter for me, and all of you guys are just attacking me? That's not exactly a denial of the accusations.
Yeah, that's the whole thing with this case. You have an Israeli prime minister in office who's been indicted.
I think institutionally that this is terrible and that it's very confusing for the public. It's confusing for journalists. It's hard to know if one relates to Netanyahu now as an indicted criminal charged with really terrible acts of betraying public trust, or if one has to address him as a prime minister like any other. I think it's very complicated, but Netanyahu really refuses even to acknowledge the possibility of not remaining in office. And I just conducted an interview with a right-wing columnist. I'm trying to understand how Netanyahu's base may be responding to this. And he basically said that they're going to stick with Netanyahu, but then he chuckled and he said, you know, cemeteries are chock full of people who were irreplaceable. So I think we may be edging towards the end of an era.
Reporter Noga Tarnopolsky in Jerusalem. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
It's March 1st, another day of reckoning in the U.S.-China trade war. Today was supposed to be the deadline for China to shape up. If not, the Trump administration would increase tariffs on more than 6,000 types of Chinese imports. But President Trump is backing off. He's delayed a new round of tariffs and says, quote, substantial progress is being made in negotiations with China. Here's more from The World's Jason Margolis.
The art of the deal. Again. Or maybe not this time. Not with China, says economist Derek Scissors.
The idea that we're going to get the greatest deal ever, is not going to pan out, and it's going to blow up in his face.
Meaning if Trump runs for president in 2020, he'll have some explaining to do.
And a Democratic candidate will be quoting candidate Trump in 2016 over and over again about how China's, he actually said the words, they're raping our country.
We can't continue to allow China to rape our country, and that's what they're doing.
And then on Sunday, he said, we had the best relationship we've ever had with China. It's very difficult to see how things have changed in the last 2 years or 2.5 years.
Scissors focuses on the Chinese economy at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank in Washington. He just doesn't see what the Trump administration has been able to get from the Chinese that other administrations haven't. For example, one major sticking point in U.S.-China relations has been the forced transfer of technology, where American companies hand over intellectual property in order to do business in China. Trump has said that's coming to an end.
The Chinese, of course, have said they have never coerced technology transfer. It's all voluntary. So them writing a law that says we won't coerce technology transfer doesn't do anything.
With issue after issue, the Chinese are making the same old promises, he says.
As they have many times in the past, we have no enforcement mechanism as we have not had in the past, and none of those promises are going to come to fruition.
But let's say President Trump does turn out to be the master negotiator he says he is. Can he turn the ship around? For decades, U.S.-China trade has worked this way. China builds it, we buy it.
It's hard to imagine all of this being resolved right away.
Economist Katie Russ at the University of California, Davis, says if Trump really wanted to put pressure on China,
if you want to have the quickest results, then join TPP.
The Trans-Pacific Partnership, the 12-nation trade agreement brokered by President Obama. Russ says it would have shifted trade away from China to
other countries that maybe we feel more close strategic alliances with.
But President Trump withdrew from that 72 hours into his presidency and said the U.S. would pursue bilateral trade agreements instead. Of course, Trump wasn't the only one opposed to the TPP. Labor unions and many Democrats worried that it could cost American jobs. So back to China. Trump needs a deal. A few days ago, he said talks are going very well and highlighted China's commitment to buy American corn.
It's going to be selling corn, but a lot of it, a lot more than anyone thought possible.
Welcome news in Illinois, the nation's second leading corn producer. I asked senior economist Mike Doherty with the Illinois Farm Bureau if he had any details on Trump's corn plan.
We don't, and it's being treated as, well, it's possible, but we'll wait and see for it to actually happen.
Illinois is also the nation's top soy producer. China is its number one export market. But this season's export has been a bust. In retaliation for Trump's tariffs, last summer, China slapped tariffs on U.S. soybeans.
Of that crop, we're about 40% under where we normally would be at in terms of those sales to China.
Doherty says more corn sales to China won't offset this. They don't sell much corn there. Many farmers do like Trump's overall economic policies, lower taxes, fewer regulations. Still, when it comes to trade, I asked Doherty if Illinois farmers still believed in the president's message.
we're not sure exactly what that message is. What are we talking about in terms of a long-term payoff? I mean, we were a number one, number two supplier out of the world to the Chinese market for supplying their soybeans. If we could just get back to that, I think most of the farmers here would be pretty happy.
For the World, I'm Jason Margolis.
Don't believe everything you hear. That's the opening line in a full-page ad in today's Wall Street Journal. It's from the Chinese telecom giant Huawei. The company has been singled out by the U.S. government as a threat to national security. Huawei wants people here in North America to see its side of the story as it faces charges in two separate criminal cases. Joseph Moreno is a former U.S. federal prosecutor. He joins us from Washington. Joseph, let's start with the extradition case. What charges does the U.S. want to bring against Huawei CFO Mengwan Zhu?
Huawei CFO is facing effectively bank fraud charges in New York. The allegation is that she lied to banks in order to get them to conduct transactions that violate U.S. sanctions against the Iranian government. So she's facing some fairly serious charges for which she's now subject to extradition from Canada.
She was arrested back in December in Vancouver, and Canada has decided to allow the extradition hearing to proceed. Is it a difficult decision for Canada to release Mengwan Zhu to the U.S.?
It certainly will be fraught with some legal and political complications because of how visible this whole thing is, right? How public it is. Canada will look at the charges that Ms. Meng faces. So they will do a prima facie test of the evidence. They would not just extradite someone for any old reason. They want to know what the charges are, effectively what evidence the U.S. prosecutors have against her. They'll also consider other factors such as her age, her health. And they will also think about the international implications of this. And as we know, there are reports that at least three Canadians have already faced ramifications in China. So they will look at the entire geopolitical situation here. It won't just be about the narrow details of the case against Ms. Meng.
And of course, you're talking about the three Canadians who've been detained in China since Meng was arrested.
That's right. I mean, it's impossible to ignore those kinds of consequences, even though you're supposed to look at, you know, just the evidence and the strength of the case against Ms. Meng. You really can't just ignore the fact that there are international implications here and that I've already seen some and there most likely will be others.
Huawei was also in court yesterday in Seattle for an intellectual property case. What charges is Huawei facing in that case?
So it's trade secret theft, mail and wire fraud. And so the U.S. is somewhat unique. It's not a super common occurrence to see companies that are actually prosecuted. Now, individuals are prosecuted all the time, but the U.S. government occasionally will charge a company itself with crimes. The idea is that individuals alone should not be held accountable, but the company itself and the assets that the company has and the shareholders, if it's a public company. It's a really serious decision to make, not one that was taken lightly, I'm sure, by prosecutors.
Is the case in Seattle and the case of Mengwan Zhu, are they linked?
Well, I have to think this is part of an overall strategy by the U.S. government, right? The Department of Justice, no doubt, sees Huawei as a national security threat. And so the idea of intellectual property theft is one that the U.S. government has struggled with when it comes to Chinese technology companies for a while. So I have to think that they looked at a number of different alleged violations, both conducted by the company itself as well as by its senior executives. So even though the cases are different facts in different jurisdictions, I have to think that the timing of this is not a coincidence. It's a lot more than just the legality, right? There's serious, serious foreign policy implications here.
Joseph Moreno is a former U.S. federal prosecutor, and he's currently a partner at a law firm in Washington. Thanks, Joseph.
Thanks, Carol. Good to be with you.
Just ahead, the crime was blasphemy. The fatwa called for an author's death. How Salman Rushdie's book, The Satanic Verses, shaped a generation of British Muslims and still resonates today. That's ahead. You're with the World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. 30 years ago, a novel was published that stoked protests across Great Britain.
The Satanic Verses by Salman Rushdie sparked a culture war. The conflict set off a chain reaction that we're still dealing with today.
That's the voice of BBC journalist Mobeen Azhar from his new documentary and podcast, The Satanic Verses, 30 Years On. He looks at the long-term impact of the novel and the controversy that followed, including the fatwa from Iran's Ayatollah calling for Rushdie's death.
The fatwa came about
on Valentine's Day of all days. So February 14th, 1989. It was just about 4 months after The Satanic Verses was published. Now, The Satanic Verses was a novel. Salman Rushdie is, you could call him a surrealist novelist. And he'd written controversial books before. He himself was British Indian from a Muslim background. And he hadn't shied away from controversy. Now, this time around in the novel The Satanic Verses, he wrote a book about a central character called Mahound. Now, Mahound's life in the book resembles the life of the Prophet Muhammad. It's very similar, but the concept of the book suggests that this character is corrupt and he's trying to pull the wool over the eyes of the people in Saudi Arabia at the time by starting this new religion. It's satirical, but I think many Muslims perceived it to be too close to the bone.
So The Satanic Verses was published in 1988. What was the reaction to it among British Muslims at that time?
Quite a tepid response. So there was offense, but the response was really about letter writing. There was a real shift, I'd say, a few months after that in January 1989, where the demonstrations started becoming physical. And at this stage, I think things got really out of hand.
So why did the tenor of these demonstrations change?
When I speak to them about what shifted, they say they felt ignored. The affair became kind of symbolic and it became a rallying call for lots of other grievances. And so it was about blasphemy, sure it was. But it was also about things like racism in Britain at the time. You've got to understand, Britain was hosting an influx of immigrant communities. Many of these people had come from places like India and Pakistan. And historically, for decades, they had been and they had felt like second-class citizens. So there were activists in the community who I think stoked that sentiment and said, look, this is actually about our community being respected. And so because they felt ignored, I think many of those activists decided they needed to do something more radical.
Had many British Muslims actually read The Satanic Verses?
Absolutely not. So I need to make this really clear. And this was fascinating to me when I was making the documentary. I, as a part of that community, you know, I'm second generation British, Pakistani, I'm a Muslim. I'd never read the book. So I read the book whilst I was making the documentary. And the vast majority of people that I met said they'd never read it and they felt they didn't need to read it. And the reason being, one of the organizations that I met, it's called the Bradford Council of Mosques, they delegated responsibility for reading the book. So they said it would be dangerous, and I'm quoting directly, for the general public to read it. So they actually got one member of the committee and said, it is your job to read this book and decide what the appropriate reaction should be.
So much of what you cover in your documentary and the podcast is how it was the younger generation. They were the ones who responded to the politicization of Islam.
I think that's very true. You know, I met a man now in his early 50s, and he told me that he wasn't ever a very practicing Muslim. He was second generation. And he explained to me how he felt that society treated him like a second-class citizen. And so he didn't see himself as particularly religious and says that he went to a demonstration in London as a bit of a jolly. That's how he described it. He said it was a day out. And at the demonstration, he ended up being very rowdy, causing some trouble, and he got arrested. Now, when he got arrested, he said one of the police officers referred to him as a part-time Muslim.
It got things going in my head. What does it mean by a part-time Muslim? From that moment onwards, I did start to become more practicing. I started to learn more about Islam. There was a period in my life when I did start to take on some of these kind of more extreme ideas. I joined the Bosnian army, their Mujahideen division, and I became a foreign fighter. And then I went on the front line and I fought against the Serbs.
So now you're talking about jihad, basically.
Yeah.
And what's he doing today?
So today he has done a 180 and he has turned his back on political and radical Islamism. And today he actually works for the UK government in de-radicalization.
Do you see a through line between this event and Islamic extremism that some Muslim communities in the West are dealing with now?
I think there is absolutely a line between what happened and the response to the Satanic Verses and what we have seen in more recent years. What it did is it politicized an entire generation. It's so important to say this, that so many of the people that I met who were activists at the time were first-time activists, and they explained to me that at the time, religion was seen, and Islam specifically, was seen as one aspect of an identity. They were also Pakistanis, they were also Asians, they were also British. What happened 30 years ago really put the focus on religion as the primary totem that people would gather around. So, of course, a lot of these men just became more practicing. But some of these men not only became practicing, they became politicized, they became radical. They began to think of themselves as being at war with the community around them.
Wow. Mobeen, I know you went to Bradford in northern England during your research, and you brought with you a copy of the Satanic Verses. Famously, a copy of the Satanic Verses was burned in Bradford 30 years ago. What was the reaction among the Muslims you talked to there today?
I took the book back to it's a public square, to the exact same place where the book was burnt 30 years ago. And I have to say, the majority of people would engage with some of the text. And if they didn't want to engage, they were quite polite and they just said, I don't want to look at that. Some people, however, you know, kind of suggested I shouldn't be holding a copy. One individual, and you see this in the film, went much further. He actually told me I needed educating. And then maybe 10 minutes later, whilst I was speaking to someone else, he approached me. He grabbed the book out of my hand.
Come on, then. Come on, then. Come on, then.
Can I have my book?
Yo, I'm going to burn this book.
He ripped it up. And then he set it on fire.
Oh, boy.
30 years later, there was a repeat of historical events. And I, for one, found that really shocking. And I think what it really tells us is that 30 years on, there is still such a visceral response to what the book represented.
Journalist Mobeen Azhar, he's produced a documentary called The Satanic Verses, 30 Years On. He's also produced a 10-part podcast. Thanks so much, Mobeen.
Thank you.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, a kid in Kenya makes a bet on a song he thinks was written by Guns N' Roses.
I lost the bet, but discovered the music of Bob Dylan and fell into this rabbit hole, which eventually led me to Minneapolis.
His first album is out, Tales from America, ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. Brazil's carnival starts this weekend, and the samba schools have created elaborate costumes and floats for the parades and competitions. Carnival's known for political messages in between all the music and dancing, and this year, one of Rio de Janeiro's most famous samba schools will pay tribute to a local politician and rights activist who was murdered about a year ago. Catherine Osborne went to one of their rehearsals.
Deborah de Almeida swings a flag as big as her body around the dance floor. She twirls it in circles, dances a minuet with a partner, and marches the flag back and forth with a steady gaze.
As mulheres guerreiras, mulheres negras, batalhadoras, escravas, que...
It's a samba about warrior women, she says, adding, black women practically founded Brazil. Almeida is 32. She's been parading in carnival since she was 10 years old. On Monday night, she'll have a central part as a flag bearer for Mangueira, one of the top samba schools in Rio. Almeida was born and raised in the Mangueira favela. She says samba helps people in her working class community get through challenges in their lives. In her case, recently losing her job, stocking shelves at a mall.
Passando alegria e energias boas para as pessoas sempre vêm bem com a gente.
The samba school spreads good energy, she says, and it's even helped take care of her son with its after-school music programs. She says samba is about resistance, and she thinks this classic samba sums it up.
Samba agoniza, mas não morre.
Samba agonizes but doesn't die because the people will save it.
Vamos passar uma mensagem, né? A gente quer descobrir, né? Já estamos 11 meses sem saber quem matou Marielle, né?
She says samba can also pack political messaging. This year, Mangueira's theme for Carnival is the Brazilians that history ignores. They've composed a ballad called História para Ninar Gente Grande, History as it should be sung to adults. This is from a recent rehearsal. The song goes, Brazil, it's time to hear them. And it lists black abolitionists and those who fought against the country's military regime from the 1960s to 80s. Then it talks about Rio City Councilwoman Marielle Franco. She was a prominent human rights defender who was assassinated almost a year ago. Franco was black, queer, and from another Rio favela. A rare profile in Brazilian politics. No one has been arrested in her murder. Investigators say they suspect she was killed by a criminal gang linked to Rio police, and much of her political work focused on police violence in poor communities. 1 year later, Franco's murder still provokes protests in Rio, and her name and image are all over the city's unofficial street carnival parades. Come Monday, Franco's widow, Monica Benicio, will parade with Mangueira at a competition in Rio's Samba Stadium before a crowd of tens of thousands of people. Manuela Trindade is part of a group that composed this year's ballad. They wrote it, she says, thinking about a divide in Brazilian politics today.
E agora a gente está num momento do país em que algumas pessoas estão com mais.
She says in Brazil there's a growing interest in understanding history from the viewpoint of those who have traditionally been erased. But at the same time, a far-right government has just come to power. And the new president, Jair Bolsonaro, is a vocal critic of human rights defenders.
Esse mundo das escolas de samba, em alguma medida, não todas, mas enfim, podendo...
Samba schools, says Trindade, are showing that voices like Marielle Franco's won't be silenced. But for Mangueira's dancers and musicians, the problems that Franco fought to end are visible every day.
Os policiais deram tiro na casa dele, achando que ele era bandido.
Débora de Almeida says earlier this week, police in an anti-drug operation shot at her neighbor's house, narrowly missing his child. 160 people were killed by Rio police in January alone. Almeida says that makes this year's carnival theme all the more important. On Monday, more than 3,000 people will sing and dance in Mangueira's parade, and they will shout Marielle Franco's name over 20 times through Rio's Samba Stadium.
Marielle presente!
For The World, Catherine Osborne, Rio de Janeiro.
Brasil, meu nego, deixa eu te contar a história que a história não...
Fish are suffocating. Oxygen levels in the world's oceans are falling fast, threatening marine life. And climate change is the reason why. Denise Breitberg is a senior scientist at the Smithsonian Research Center. Denise, why does global warming cause oxygen levels in the ocean to fall?
There are basically two things that happen as the world is warming. The first is that the oceans are absorbing all that energy from the increased greenhouse gases and storing that as heat. And warm water simply can't hold as much oxygen as cooler water can. It's just like a soda going flat when it's left out in the sun. The other thing that happens is that as those surface waters warm, they prevent oxygen in the atmosphere from getting into the deeper waters. They keep the surface and deeper waters from mixing and affect ocean currents, so not as much oxygen is getting down to depth.
And what's the effect on marine life?
I think the best way to describe it is using the old American Lung Association motto, if you can't breathe, nothing else matters. Almost all marine life, from fish down to many of the microbes, rely on oxygen for respiration. It's the way they turn food into energy, and it's absolutely critical to life.
What's happening to marine life as a response? Are there fewer fish being born? Are they moving around to colder water? What happens?
It depends where they live, and it also depends on whether we're talking about finfish that can swim out of the way, or also shellfish, things like oysters and clams that are on the bottom and can't move when oxygen declines.
Give an example of a couple types of fish and the impact on them.
Sure. One example of fish that are really affected are things like billfish, things like marlins that normally live in oxygenated waters out in the open ocean and stay just above the low oxygen areas. And as these low oxygen areas are moving closer to the surface, the fish also are moving closer to the surface. And one concern is that that makes them easier to catch. And so we really worry about the possibility that it can cause overfishing.
What about fish that don't have fins and can't move out of the way or find more oxygenated water? What happens to them?
Well, those animals are really in trouble. They may die, they may stop reproducing, but they're in trouble.
As a scientist, are you surprised that we're already seeing the impact of less oxygenated water?
What I'm surprised about is how fast we're seeing changes. There are areas where oxygen is 30% or 40% lower than it was middle of the 20th century.
Is there anything we can do about it?
Luckily, there is. We have got to move towards a decarbonized future. There's no question about that. And it's going to take the equivalent of a effort that put a man on the moon. But it's clearly what we need to do, not just to restore oxygen to the ocean's waters, but to really rescue civilization as we know it.
Denise Breitberg is a senior scientist at the Smithsonian Research Center. Thanks a lot, Denise.
Thank you.
Let me take you back to 1918. World War I has just ended, the Russian Revolution is underway, and U.S. troops are fighting in Russia. Wait, what? This is history Americans have mostly overlooked, but for a year after the First World War ended, U.S. and Allied troops remained in combat in Russia against the Bolsheviks. James Carl Nelson, the author of a new book, tells the story. Your book is called The Polar Bear Expedition, after the nickname. How did they get that moniker?
They kind of anointed themselves as polar bears towards the end of the war. They knew they had been through something very special, and they're so far up towards the Arctic, not quite in polar bear territory, but they basically lived like animals in the cold, 50, 60, 70 below, and it just seemed apropos. So they had a special patch made up for them. They needed a special moniker, and that's what they came up with.
So how did it work out? Did they see a lot of combat against the Russians up in Archangel?
Yeah. The 339th Regiment landed in Archangel on September 5th, 1918. And instead of guarding stores, were immediately hustled off their transports by the British commanders who were running the operation and sent hundreds of miles to the south. They met combat immediately within days of heading up the river or down the railway line. And the combat continued until April.
What kind of casualties?
They lost 235 men. About 70 of those died of the flu in the first weeks after landing at Archangel. Their transports were flu-ridden. The rest were killed in action, died of wounds. There were a few accidents. So they had some significant casualties.
At what point in this operation does World War I end?
It ended on November 11th, 1918, even as these units were strung out across a 400-mile front south of Archangel. And in fact, ironically, I guess, Company B of the 339th was stationed at Tulgas, about 200 miles south of Archangel on the Dvina River. And on Armistice Day, they were attacked by hundreds of Bolsheviks and spent 3 days fighting for their lives. And then the rest of the winter building up their fortifications and still fighting off the predations of these Bolshevik warriors.
So the point is World War One ends and they're still fighting Russians. U.S. troops fighting Russians.
Yeah. It became a real source of frustration among some of the troops. Like, why, you know, all these other men who fought in France are going home. Why are we here? They never got a good answer of why they were there, especially There was no reason anymore to rebuild the Eastern Front if that's what they had given them. There was no reason to guard stores against the predations of Bolsheviks or Germans with the war over. So there was no real clear intent of what they were doing there.
So how did it come to an end?
Basically, Woodrow Wilson understood finally that his troops were being misused and had, in fact, been engaged in combat with the Bolsheviks. And there was a growing movement in the U.S., started probably with the relatives, and Woodrow Wilson finally in mid-February 1919 said, yeah, you know what, I want these guys out of here by summer, which there was no way they could have left in February because the White Sea was frozen up at Archangel. But slowly, beginning probably in late March and into April, they started drawing the troops back from these fronts. They gathered at Archangel and sailed out in the first week of June of 1919.
These soldiers were mostly from Michigan. You really got to know them in your research. Tell us which man made the biggest impression on you.
I think it'd have to be Harry Meade from Valparaiso, Indiana. His family ran a boarding house. He was the commander of the 4th Platoon of Company A. It was the most far-flung platoon, 250 miles from Archangel at a place called Nizhny Gora. And on the morning of January 19th, 1919, he and the 45 men under him were attacked by 1,300 Bolsheviks and endured a running month-long flight for safety. 25 of his men were killed in action, and their bodies, actually many of their bodies, were not found until 10 years later when an expedition went back to collect bodies.
That was very striking, the fact that these guys went back in 1929 to Soviet Russia to recover the bodies of their fallen comrades.
Yeah, when they got back to the Detroit area, they formed the Polar Bear Association to keep the memory alive, to honor the sacrifices of their fallen. They had brought about 112 bodies back on the transports that brought them to the U.S., but that left more than 100 still strung out in graves around Russia. And so they raised some funds, went to Europe. A contingent of about 5 or 10 of these men were finally allowed to get into Russia. They went back to the battle areas where they'd been, and they located and disinterred another 86 bodies and brought those back to the United States.
You write that a lot of Americans have forgotten about this episode. What about the Russians? Do they remember it?
Much more remembered in Russia than in America. When the intervention ended, Bolshevists were able to use their repulsion of this intervention to great propaganda effect, saying, hey, look, we drove out the invaders. And I think, you know, there was great umbrage at the invasion that somebody had tried to come in and mess in their internal affairs. So, yeah, they've kept the flame of this alive through the years. The average Russian is much more aware of this intervention than anybody in the United States probably would be.
Was it considered a success or failure?
Oh, it was an abject failure. I mean, they didn't accomplish anything. You know, think of the designs, especially the big overarching idea of undoing the revolution. I mean, basically, they were lucky to get out with their lives.
James Carl Nelson is author of The Polar Bear Expedition, The Heroes of America's Forgotten Invasion of Russia, which is out this month. Thanks a lot.
Thank you very much.
Thanks to Minnesota Public Radio in St. Paul for use of their studios. Long before the days of American Idol, there was Eurovision. The International Song Contest goes back to the 1950s. It's still going strong, and for fans, it's the most fabulous event of the year. Eurovision doesn't actually happen until May, but there's been some political drama playing out already. Ukraine has dropped out of the contest. Paul Jordan is an expert on Eurovision, and he joins us from the BBC in London. Paul, why did Ukraine pull out of Eurovision this year?
Ukraine have pulled out of the competition over tensions with Russia. They had a national selection show to choose their act for the Eurovision finals in May, and the winning act withdrew her entry from the competition after she was asked to sign an agreement. She disagreed with some of the political points in there. She felt that she was being used as a political tool against Ukraine.
And what was she being asked to do that she disagreed with? And we should say the artist is named Maruv.
She was asked during the live shows whether she considered Crimea to be part of Russia or Ukraine.
Crimea is Ukraine?
Ukraine, of course.
They were almost testing her loyalty to the country.
So now Ukraine has no participant in the Eurovision Song Contest in May. How big of a deal is this?
This is quite a big scandal, and it's a scandal because it's one of Ukraine's own making. This is the broadcaster itself that have deliberately politicised their own competition. But this isn't the first time something like this has happened. In 2017, when the contest was held in Ukraine, Russia withdrew over tensions with the host country. And also in 2009, the Georgian entry, that was called We Don't Want to Put In. That came the year after the war with Russia. Now, they denied that it was political, but they refused to change the lyrics, so therefore had to withdraw from the competition.
So there's a huge irony here, because aren't the origins of the Eurovision Song Contest all about fostering unity? I mean, a sort of post-war effort to foster unity among European nations?
Well, Eurovision started in the 50s almost as a television experiment to bring countries together in the spirit of friendly competition. But you do see politics entering the contest year upon year, even though the organisers try to make sure that the politics doesn't come into it. But like any large-scale international event, whether it be the World Cup or the Olympic Games, politics is there bubbling under the surface.
Paul, I have to ask, you've written your dissertation on Eurovision. You even go by the name Dr. Eurovision. How did you get into this?
Well, it was an idea that came when I was studying history and politics at Glasgow University, and it was at the time that Ukraine had just won Eurovision, and there was the Orange Revolution going on as well. So they were trying to prepare for this contest against the backdrop of, you know, a big revolution. And my tutor at the time suggested that I might want to write my undergrad dissertation on that. I did. And then when that finished, he suggested that I might want to apply for a PhD, as he felt there were different topics to explore. So in particular, I looked at Estonia and Ukraine, this concept of nation branding, the idea of selling the state on the world stage, using pop culture, in particular Eurovision, as a way of doing so. But it actually got into a lot of debates about national identity, and a lot of it was about saying who they were. They were not former Soviet, they were Western European countries, or certainly in Estonia's case, they considered themselves to be Nordic, and they really didn't like this idea of being seen as linked with Russia. They very much wanted to be aligned with Scandinavia, and that's what they tried to do through Eurovision and the way in which they hosted the event.
Paul Jordan is an expert on Eurovision. Thanks a lot, Paul.
No worries, thank you.
That's Maruv from Ukraine with Siren Song. Here's one more music story that'll take us into the weekend. Kenyan musician J.S. Ondara tells us about the inspirations behind his debut album.
My heart is never on time, always a little behind.
The album's called Tales of America. It is a combination of a couple of different stories that would be my experiences being in America for the last 5 years. I moved here from Kenya 5 years ago. And so the album is this journey of me trying to adapt to the life of America and dealing with the new challenges as they arise.
If you pray hard to you God, he will lay her on a golden pod.
I grew up listening to a lot of rock music, and then at some time in high school I had this very huge fight with a fellow student about the song Knocking on Heaven's Door.
Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
I always thought it was a Guns N' Roses song, and this student tells me, oh no, it's actually originally by this folk singer called Bob Dylan. So we got into this fight and we made a bet.
Knock, knock,
lost the bet, but by virtue discovered the music of Bob Dylan and fell into this rabbit hole, which eventually led me to Minneapolis, which is his home state.
That long black cloud is coming down. I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
A very romantic thing to do, you know, do whatever my heart calls me to do. And I felt a sort of, I think it's one of the reasons why I felt this sort of kinship with Dylan, is because while I was delving into his persona as a person in his life, I felt that he was such a romantic as well. He would just pick up and say, oh, I'm going to go to New York now because Guthrie's over there. Or, you know, I'm going to make a rock album. Now I'm going to make a gospel album. And that sort of romantic way of approaching life is something that I feel very connected to and is an integral part of how I live my day-to-day life.
He was just in America.
American Dream is the opening track in the album. It's one of the songs that I suppose I toiled over the most in the record, because I wanted a song called American Dream in the album, since it's such a pertinent thing to my journey coming here. But I didn't have it, so I wrote 20 songs called American Dream, just different songs. This is American Dream, American Dream. The one that ended up being in the album is the 21st version of that. And in that song, I think it's just me trying to deliberate on what the American Dream, that idea means or could mean from someone who's an outsider, and what that would compare to what it could be once you moved here and you've actually seen what life in America is. And so it was me trying to ponder about that, about the idea of American Dream.
J.S. Ondara telling us about his debut album, Tales of America. The world's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend. Love, I don't make a sound.
PRI, Public Radio International.